Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
The podcast not for turning. Strike up the band!
We offered him some cake or a biscuit.
Oliver Letwin brought the snacks himself, Viennese biscuits.
I think it shrinks him. I just think
better if he was round.
Yes, here we are again. It's how to win an election, you insider's guide to the huge political year ahead. I'm Matt Chorley, joined as ever by new Labour mastermind Peter Mandelson, Tory brain box Daniel Finkelstein, and beaming in via satellite technology, Polly McKenzie. Morning, Polly.
Morning, Matt. I'm sorry that I'm at the Sadler's Wells Theatre doing my real job.
Doing your one-woman show.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a ballet dancer in my spare time, but I don't mention that.
Coalition negotiations to the medium of dance. But anyway, it's nice you've joined us anyway, Polly. And Peter and Daniel here as well. If you want to send us questions, you can email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. Even better, if you email us a voice note. And I think next week we might try and do a whole load of listener questions. If you've got a burning question for the panel, email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. It seems like the Labour Party have been listening to the podcast, but they can't work out whether or not to agree with Peter or to agree with Danny on the question of the £28 billion pledge to spend on green projects by the end of the next Parliament. Here is what Peter was saying about it more than a month ago.
The concept was absolutely sound. I support it. I personally wouldn't have chosen a figure because I think that your ability to pursue this policy of investment will depend on the economic circumstances at the time. And therefore, to sort of pre-announce a figure so far in advance was not realistic.
So that was what Peter said. And this very day, Keir Starmer speaking to Times Radio.
I've been unwavering in relation to the mission, clean power by 2030. And I keep getting challenges from people saying, you're moving the date back. That mission of clean power by 2030, I haven't moved that date back at all. And I'm very clear, we need investment to do that. We need to borrow to invest to do that. That's a principle I believe in and I'm absolutely happy to go out and defend. And of course, what we've said as we got closer to the operationalisation of this is that'll have to be ramped up. The money will have to be ramped up, the 28 billion, etc. And everything is, of course, subject to our fiscal rules.
So the 28 billion, etc. You're sticking to the number, Peter.
Look, I think what we've got to distinguish is between borrowing and investment. I support the investment. I want to achieve the clean power goal by 2030. I want to achieve net zero by 2050. And by the way, between now and 2050, you're going to be spending and investing an enormous amount more than 28 billion in order to achieve this energy transition as a whole. And by the way, from that is going to come, I hope, you know, some significant reindustrialization of our country, the use of new technologies, new industries being built on the back of them, new businesses being created and new jobs. And that's what I want to see. But here's the point, Matt. that investment, and it's the investment we should be focused on rather than defining the success of Labour's policy by how much borrowing can be undertaken. It's the achievement, that the investment that we achieve, that's the most important thing. And that is going to come from a mixture of public and private. But since that commitment was made, the cost of borrowing, thank you, Liz Truss, has gone through the roof. And that has to be taken into account. And secondly, it's become very clear over the last few years that the private sector is queuing up to undertake investment in our green transition. So we are going to be relying much more on private investment than public than was originally thought. And that's why the figures need to be adjusted in order to reflect that.
It's a very good answer from Peter there, ignoring the fact that he said he shouldn't have put a figure on it. And Peter, because I was sticking to the figure. What do you think about this debate, very public debate, it's been going on in the Labour Party. Should they have put a figure?
I was desperately hoping you were going to replay my clip so I could remember what I'd actually said so that I don't contradict myself.
I think you said that you thought that probably putting a figure on it was a bad idea, but having put a figure on it, you should stick to it.
Yeah, I favour the reassurance strategy, but I think that once they're on this, they may as well stick with it. Look, the bottom line, you'd probably expect me to say this, is I don't think this is going to move the dial a lot. and the reason for it, is because I think people have got a sort of reasonably a stronger view of Starmer than they have of Sunak. They want to remove the Conservative Party from government. They're probably not going to get themselves too stuck on one policy, as long as the overall image is that they're being relatively careful. It's certainly an opening. I wouldn't have led on 28 billion. I can't really quite understand why you would want to keep on using phrases like ramp up. I think those are really bad phrases. And, you know, it would also obviously be a good idea if, when we're going to borrow that amount of money, we had a clearer idea that it would be well spent, even though the objectives sound like good ones. Green something or other, right? You know, my view is, generally speaking, you have more latitude in government to carry out these policies than you do in opposition, where the kind of change seems threatening, people are loss averse. But actually, I think in circumstances where Labour's move, you know, I think Labour does have a danger of running for office saying, this situation is absolutely terrible. Let's be sure to do nothing about it. And so I therefore do think having some emblematic policies is not... You can live with the downsides
Danny,
of it.
Nobody's saying this is absolutely terrible. You know, let's run away from it. We're saying this is a huge opportunity for the country if we get this transition right. And by the way, there are so many moving parts in it which affect energy consumers, car drivers, homeowners, businesses, whatever.
What I'm saying is it's
very exciting. We can get an enormous amount from the country from it if we do it well, but it requires ambitious levels of investment. Sorry. And overwhelmingly, the bulk of that investment is going to come from the private sector, not from public borrowing.
I didn't make myself as clear as I should. I'm not saying I'm not talking about the policy here. I'm talking about the Labour Party potentially saying, "Look, the Tories are running the country really badly, and everything's falling apart. But we haven't got very ambitious plans to put in place." So you probably do have to have some alternative program that people can recognise. I just think leading all the time on the number and using phrases like ramping up.
Phil Collins wrote a very good article in the Times yesterday about this, and he said you don't do politics by numbers, and he's right.
Yeah, Polly, what do you think about this? Because some of the criticism, while some on the Labour front bench have been very keen, they should drop the number, and it's become an albatross, and it's as a reason to attack. If they do drop this as a big idea, there is not a lot else going on.
I think policy is often talked about in numbers, and it's talked about in input numbers. I'm going to put £28 billion in. You know, Gordon Brown's budgets were always characterised by him just listing the billions. And he would always say 3 billions and 19 billions. And he would add them up and talk about how much money he was putting in. Boris Johnson would always talk about how the number of people he was hiring, and hire some nurses and build some hospitals and do some stuff. And they do that because, oddly enough, it seems to work quite well with the public as a way of understanding things and understanding mechanisms. But of course, the inputs aren't what matter. What matters is the destination, the goal. And that kind of thinking is what Keir Starmer's trying to shift towards when he talks about emissions. The idea what matters is clean energy by 2030. And I mean, honestly, like if it was 27 and a half billion, we'd be going, oh, so you totally failed. You didn't put the right amount of money in. Equally, if it costs 35 billion, we have to get there. And it's a shame because I think Keir Starmer is genuinely onto something with a different approach to policymaking. But he's undermining that story by just sort of talking about inputs.
Yeah.
And that's actually not where the difference is made.
Well, we'll wait and see if it's changed by next week. Polly, you know, I know you said you were at Sadler's Wells. Are you actually at PopCon?
Oh, my God. Under the radar at PopCon. No, it is not my style.
You're not the big defector for Liz Truss's launch of popular conservatism. Do we need another group, Danny?
No, look, I, you know, you have to admire Liz's chutzpah. You do. It's extraordinary. To be honest, to place the label, and first of all, to place the label popular on anything that she's associated
should
with.
Should be unpopular.
Exactly. So it is odd. But secondly, it's obvious that you cannot get a new mission for the Conservative Party out of attachment to Liz, whether or not her arguments have value to, and you know, and other Conservatives believe in them. She cannot be the front person for it. That I cannot understand how that is not obvious to her allies, and perhaps it is, yeah. You know, which is why it's been accompanied by Kwasi Kwarteng deciding to stand down from Parliament, and at the same time, Simon Clark deciding he's not going to go.
So I think Simon Clark was uninvited after he called for Rishi Sunak to go. Vanil Jayawardena announced yesterday that he wasn't. So when they first announced this a couple of weeks ago, the lineup was Jacob Rees-Mogg, Liz Truss, Simon Clark, and Vanil Jayawardena. And unpopular conservatism has become less popular in the last 2 weeks. So there's only now two of them on the bill.
Just to let's do the thing we do. Let's be fair to Liz Truss. Okay. So okay.
Those mugs are going to take some shifting on the workshop.
So having said the things that I've said and knowing where I stand, she stands for a certain kind of Laffer curve idea, right? Which is you cut taxes and it increases growth, and you accompany that with a whole bunch of stimulating policies. I think that for economic growth, I think that has got attractions to other conservatives, and it has got attractions to a demographic actually as well. The problem I've got with it is I don't think it's correct. I don't think that's what would happen. And you know, I think that is what she experienced in that period in office. Now, the response she might have to that is, well, we never got to that point. We, you know, the markets incorrectly took the view that what I did wouldn't work, and therefore they were spooked and they ran away from it. But it would work. That's her argument. I think that is the strong case for what she's proposing. But what I would say to her is, even if you are correct, and I, you know, I've suggested the way she is and she isn't, you possibly, Liz Truss, cannot be the front person for it. That is obvious.
Peter.
There's only one very simple way of understanding this. They think they've lost the election and they're fighting for the soul of the Conservative Party and control and direction of the Conservative Party after the next election. That's what they're doing.
Yes,
and they're getting
was,
their...
There was a hilarious line in the Times on Saturday which said, it's understood that Liz has given up on her leadership ambitions. Which,
well,
I actually
just as well, given that the rest of the country has
done
so as well.
As I read that in the paper. Polly, I just sort of wonder what she thinks the point of it is.
I think it's really tough to give up on a life and career in politics. It's quite hard to do anything else, frankly, because, you know...
I'm talking about Liz Truss now, not you, Polly.
Well, she and I, we own the same dress,
yes,
Kat,
of course,
as we've discussed before. So,
yeah.
Sisters from another mister.
Well, you got yours from a charity shop, though, didn't you?
Well, I mean, that is true. Being a person...
Somebody's put something in Matt's tea to this morning. Yeah. I don't know what's got in
it. I've been to Downing Street this morning. I've got a bit overexcited.
Oh, you're all excited,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah, giddy. Mm. You must remember going to Downing Street, Peter. I know it was a long time ago now.
Once or twice.
Sorry, Polly, go on.
Oh, I can't remember. I went to Downing Street once too.
But I think that Polly's right, though. You're suggesting basically that while she may not want to run for the leadership, she's got an idea and she's sort of going to keep going because what else would she do next?
What is her big idea? Just to break the bank all over again.
No, the idea, and it's been a very potent one inside conservative thinking for a long time, is that you improve growth primarily by removing restrictions from businesses, and you can probably cut taxes more rapidly than people think because there's a supply side effect, right? You get an increase in growth as a result of it. I'm very questioning of that approach, and also so therefore, you know, the bit that was missing in her manifesto seemed to me to be a policy of control of public spending to go along with it, which I don't think was, by the way, practical at the time that she was proposing it, given the other things that were happening. So there's no doubt she has got a central intellectual idea, that idea has got a lot of adherence, that it has an intellectual heritage, and that there is a demographic for that kind of optimistic idea. My problem with it is I don't think it accords with reality. And right from the beginning, I said I think her biggest problem is not going to be winning the Conservative leadership. It's going to be the battle against reality. And in that battle, reality ultimately always wins.
But it's the fate of all ideologues, right? Is people say about communism, you know, oh, the reason communism has failed is because real communism has never been tried. You know, Liz Truss has the belief that her real free market libertarianism never really got tried because the free markets got in the way of free marketism. It would be impossible to surrender that worldview in the face of reality if you're an ideologue.
Yeah.
Danny is a Bayesian. He changes his mind when new facts arise, as he, you know, described it to us last week. So, to my mind, those are the kind of people we ought to have as our leaders, people who are willing to adapt and negotiate with reality instead of trying to pretend that there's some sort of imagined version of life over the hill, over the rainbow, wherever it might be.
Very good, very good. But in a minute, let's turn on our turn. We'll leave Liz Truss to just wallow it popcorn. And we're going to talk about focus groups and polling, and the extent to which political parties use them, should they ignore them. We've got some exclusive polling on Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer. Neither of them come out of it terribly well, has to be said. So we'll do that next on How to Win an Election.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Yeah, this is How to Win an Election. I'm Matt Shorley, joined by Peter Manson, Polly McKenzie and Daniel Finkelstein. So I wanted to talk to you today about polls and focus groups and the extent to which parties do use them or should use them. We've got some new YouGov polling for Times Radio, which shows Britain's delivered an overwhelming thumbs down to both Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer in what's shaping up to be a none-of-the-above election. In a string of key questions on suitability for the job of running the country, voters refuse to choose either Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer, with neither topping the polls on a whole string of things of who is statesmanlike, able to handle a crisis, good at leading us in a war, working with President Trump, speaking like a normal person. Neither comes out on top. Just 23% of people would be delighted by a Keir Starmer Labour government, although 54% would be dismayed if the Conservatives returned under Rishi Sunak. Obviously, all of this with the caveat that the Labour Party are still, what, 20, 21 points ahead in the polls. We've also got a new focus group of which we've been doing every month on Times Radio since the middle of 2020. So these are former Tory voters. They voted Conservative in 2019. Now say they'll vote Labour. This is what they had to say about both Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer.
On all five priorities, we have made progress.
Just find him really smug at the minute. I don't know why, just the way he looks.
I find him very patronising and smug.
I think he's a bit of an idiot.
I think he's a bit of a puppet.
To me, he's uninspiring.
Just bring it on.
Corporate.
He comes across a lot more enthusiastic and more sincere.
Slightly more normal and a bit more likeable.
A little bit more down to earth than other people.
He's to the point, there's no wishy-washy with him.
Still very privileged, says it as it is, and a fighter and determined.
And you'll be able to hear more of the focus group on the Politics Up the Boring Bits podcast. So, Danny.
Matt, give me your bell for a second. Okay. This one really matters.
Hey!
So obviously, comparative leadership matters hugely. No one has ever won an election when they're behind on both the economy and leadership. That's where the Tories are. What matters about your poll is not the fact that you've shown that people not generally enthused by both sets of politicians, which, by the way, was even the case with Tony Blair. Mm. Less, more so with Starmer, but even the case with Tony Blair before 1997. What matters is how people view them comparatively, and there's a pretty clear gap which has opened up. And you can see that, you know, Rishi Sunak might have hoped the Conservative impressions of the Conservative Party would move to him, instead of which it's happened the other way around. So I really listen very closely to focus groups. I'm sure Peter does too. One of the crucial things in the run-up to 1997, you know, was the Conservative Party for a long time didn't have proper focus groups. When it did, it had a tendency to think they were really secret. I kept saying, why would it be secret if it leaked what people thought, since they already thought it? So I couldn't understand why we were keeping it secret, and I wanted to share it within the group because it was incredibly valuable. Yeah. So I you know, I know some people say, oh, it's not scientific because they're only a group of people. I find it really, really useful in every professional sphere that I'm involved in. I get myself involved in focus group work, and I find it really, really useful.
Polly, what do you think?
I love focus groups. I mean, The way that you can bring a group of people together to help remind you as the decision maker, which is absolutely used in policy as well as politics, the decision makers are usually weird. You're usually out of touch. You don't know what's going on in the ground. So if you're trying to design a welfare system or a health system, you absolutely need to understand the people and how they are engaging with them. And that qualitative research is exploratory, it's uncontrolled, incredibly insightful. What it doesn't tell you is the representative sample, whether these opinions that you're hearing often for the first time are in fact common, uncommon, and in what demographics they're likely to be held. So you have to pair that qualitative focus group research with quantitative, with polling or with surveys, to help you really understand where ideas are landing and build actually a kind of strategy for what you do about it.
Peter, it's always struck me that there are two ways of using polls and focus groups. You can either come up with a policy, put it to them, and if it gets the thumbs down, you go, oh, well, we better not do that then. Or, and this seems to have slightly fallen out of fashion in politics, if you think a policy is a good idea, you try to find ways of persuading, leading, changing public opinion. Mm. And it seems like sometimes the response to polls and focus groups is a bit literal. They're like, this isn't popular, so we should drop it. That's not, you know, that's proven popular, so we should do more of it. Rather than thinking that the political leaders have any sort of agency in changing political opinion.
That's always assuming that the policy was right in the first place. And sometimes it wasn't.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, actually rubbish in, rubbish out. You've been badly advised and you've reached a point where actually you've got to change the policy, yeah. Not least because the facts change and you sort of look at it again. It has to work. So there's no point in sticking to a policy which is, either not justified or isn't going to work or around which the facts have changed and you've got to, work it out in a different way. It doesn't necessarily mean to say that you're going to lower your ambition. It just means that you're going to do it in a different way. But Matt, there's another thing about opinion polls is that they can be used by anyone to tell a particular story. And you've used this YouGov poll in order to make out that the public regards Sunak and Starmer completely equally, a plague on both their houses. And I've got the poll in front of me. And I've got the poll in front of me. Let me make my point. I've got the poll in front of me. And on each of the 9 questions that you ask, Starmer is significantly ahead of Sunak. And given what Danny said, which is that
elections... Well, if we're being completely accurate, Peter, he's not ahead on one of them. Rishi Sunak is ahead on better at working with President Trump.
We don't have President Trump. we have President Biden. Thank you very much. And he's ahead by literally one point. Margin of error. And, of course, Mr. Biden is in office and not Mr. Trump.
But given that the Labour Party is 20 points ahead in the polls, Keir Starmer is, 3 or 4 points ahead on most of these?
No, but this is very important. And Danny made this point. Politics is comparative. Elections are about a choice. And, there are quite a lot of people who say, well, both equally, I don't like them either. But in the case of both equally, even that is significantly lower than the support for Keir Starmer on each of those 9 questions. And where people are making a choice, it's not between sort of, perfection or the ideal in somebody. It's between 2 individuals, 2 parties and 2 sets of policies. And who are you going to plump for?
I think Matt was just, because last week you were telling us that we must be very careful not to get ahead of ourselves for Labour. And Matt was just trying to fit in with that, wasn't he? Yes.
You've drunk the Kool-Aid since last week, haven't you, Peter? After I think
polls have their limitations. Yeah. Now, let me make my point about polls. And why they're limited. First of all, the questions you ask, how you ask them, will strongly influence the answers that you get. You can just get about any answer or any conclusion you want from a poll, depending on how you answer and how you analyse. How you ask and how you analyse. It's much better to go into a longer conversation with a representative group of voters, and you can go much deeper and you can probe into what they really think. But 2 other points on this. First of all, it depends on who's conducting the focus group. And if they're rubbish at focus groups, they don't really understand what they're doing. They've got no experience of talking to voters and they take the wrong conclusions. You can sort of contaminate the research rather than get answers from it.
Philip,
so again,
rubbish
in, rubbish out. But let me make the third point, which is this. research is one thing. It's how you convert it into a strategy. It's how you can convert it into messages. It's how you convert it into the battleground that you're trying to construct and how you're trying to frame the choice in an election. And the truth is that historically, the Conservatives have been better at that than Labour. I mean, I'm not just talking about the last 10 years where, of course, it was obvious, but historically. And where Labour trumped the Conservatives is when we employed a guy, I recruited a guy to work for the Labour Party in 1985, a guy called Philip Gould. Mm. And together we created something called the Shadow Communications Agency. It was drawn chiefly from really good, professional, sophisticated people working in advertising. They were not just sort of polling people. They introduced the concept of focus groups to the Labour Party and how they researched, how they analysed and how they develop messages from that research and from those focus groups, became a hugely important driver for Labour's later success. So, I mean, that was a good hire Philip Gould, yeah, and he became the Labour Party's chief strategist and pollster for decades after, and tragically he died after, not long after the 2010 election, and we've missed him ever since, quite honestly. He's not been replaced. It's a great shame.
Can I ask Polly a question? Polly, one of my theses, and you... please, you know, correct me, because it may not be right, was that it was a significant problem for the Liberal Democrats, both in office and in the campaign, that it's expensive to have these kind of focus groups and opinion polls, and therefore they were being outbought by people. You know, you can get real insight. You can't ask a focus group what your NHS policy would be. That'd be hopeless. But you can, you know, for example, the phrase "we're all in this together" came from a focus group. It established that people were willing to look after, to accept certain sacrifices, providing they felt everyone was having them. Whether or not the Conservative Party lived by that is a different question, but as you know, that insight came out of focus group. So was my instinct correct? Because I mean, it was just an instinct. I have no idea whether from the front line it was right.
I think it's certainly always a dynamic for smaller parties, including the Liberal Democrats, just that they haven't got the money and the resources, or often all of the experts that you might be able to deploy if you are in one of the bigger parties and you've just got more kind of influence and impact. You're more worth working for. Only weirdos, right, end up working for the Liberal Democrats, such as myself. So it's definitely a dynamic that, you know, the focus groups that we would do or the polling, often relatively limited samples, often relatively few numbers of questions. And that does affect your ability to come up with a great strategy. But of course, the other much bigger dynamic is that in the end, you're the third party in a first-past-the-post system that is brutally sort of prejudiced against you. Because if people know the one most important thing about the Liberal Democrats is that they're probably not going to win, and they're probably not going to win in my seat. And no genius strategy actually can get you past that. So I wouldn't kind of imagine that, oh, if only somebody gave the Liberal Democrats £1 million and they did some amazing polling, then boom, first past the post disappears. If you're a small party, you're a small party.
And then, Polly, when you were then, particularly in government and doing policy, was there a tension between the people doing the polling and the focus groups and then you coming up with policy? Because actually, the conversation we've had repeated, there's sort of two big arguments going on. You've got stop the boats, polls lovely, goes down well in the focus groups. Nobody quite knows what the policy is to make that happen. £28 billion on green investment, probably a good idea in terms of, you know, the green economy and jobs and economy. Quite difficult to explain, you know, in a focus group in polling, probably people wouldn't go. So did you find when you were policy McKenzie in Number 10, did people come along and say, oh, no, you know, it needs to be more straightforward, and you saying, well, actually, no, this is a really complicated problem?
I think my reflection on our time in government is that we were hopelessly disconnected really from just politics, from thinking really politically in that brutal way about how things were being interpreted by voters. We had, I think, a naive assumption that if we, I guess, did our best by the country, that people would understand that and respect it. And do you know what? Like, naivety gets you absolutely nowhere in politics. I think we were just fundamentally wrong. There was one moment where polling really did make the difference on a policy issue, which is on plastic bags. So you'll remember that you now have to pay 5p, 10p, sometimes 50p for a plastic bag at the checkout. That was introduced by the coalition government, though it didn't come in until 2015. But we managed to persuade George Osborne this is like my finest hour, really, of negotiation. When George Osborne said, I'm not going to introduce a £50 million tax on this, and we passed some polling across the table. We didn't tell him that it was polling of Liberal Democrat considerers, but nevertheless it was. And it suggested that it was ruinously popular to introduce a plastic bag tax, and we persuaded him live in the room with a grand moment of deception.
Peter, when you were when you were sort of in the cabinet, would you listen into focus groups of people talking about you?
I have never attended or participated in a focus group.
But you're the king. You're the king of...
I know I'm the king of focus groups. I know that I presided over their introduction to the Labour Party. I know I created the Shadow Communications Agency in Philip Gould in order to drive our research, but I've never actually been to one. And I, partly because I relied on Philip Gould to do that, but also because I don't, there's a bit of me that feels, well, look, I can wait for the readout. I can wait for the report as long as the person doing it is good enough. And I tell you something, I don't mean this immodestly, but I've never been completely surprised by what I've learned from a focus group. I mean, I've had my instincts reinforced. I've had my sort of prejudices strengthened. I mean, I've been able to sort of tweak, you know, things here and there, but nothing fundamentally has ever been revealed to me in a focus group.
Okay, so one of the things that I've learned a lot from the polling and particularly from focus groups is it's helped inform my view about how disengaged most people are with politics. And you sort of ask them factual questions, they've got no idea what you're talking about. And I once persuaded Newsnight that it would be a good idea to have a proper focus group in the studio and to discuss Ed Miliband. I thought it was pretty interesting because I think when you looked at focus groups, they basically showed he was whole below the waterline. And I thought it was would be very good political reporting. And they agreed to do it. They got this. And then that week, phone hacking began. And so they rang me up and said, we're going to ask the group about phone hacking instead of Ed Miliband. And I said, I really don't do that because they won't have an... Anyway, this programme was a disaster. Nobody... I was on with Deborah Mattinson, who now works for Keir Starmer as doing the focus groups, and she'll, you know, she'll say the same thing. Basically, nobody had anything to say about this. They didn't know who we were talking about. Who was Andy Coulson? What? Who? You know, they sort of knew who Rupert Murdoch was.
Can I give you two examples? It was extraordinary. So, yeah.
And the people in the BBC were completely shocked by this. And the most important thing I learned from focus groups, and Peter's now ingested this, and so have I, I'm sure Polly has too, is that you no longer, you realise people don't know these things.
I gave you two examples, one from the 80s, one from the 90s. In the 1980s, the Labour Party was struggling with its policy to renationalise everything in sight. And there was opinion polling done which showed that the public supported nationalisation. That was a bit surprising. So eventually we go into a focus group, a few focus groups, and we discover that once you sort of go below the surface, people are not quite sure what you mean by nationalisation. Secondly, they think that nationalisation state control means that their bills are going to be lower. And thirdly, they don't think you are making a choice between, you know, lower consumer prices and investment, which of course is at the heart of, you know, how you manage these great utilities. And so that when you did the focus group, you discovered all sorts of sort of questions and queries and reservations about nationalisation, including, do you want to use all that money to renationalise an industry, or do you want to use it on a health service? In the 1990s, we had the same over the top rate of tax. Some people, including some people next door to the Prime Minister, kept coming with polls saying, you know, increasing the top rate of tax is very, very popular. You do focus groups and you discover actually it triggers all sorts of concerns and reservations people have about labour and tax, whether that top rate is going to go downwards and suddenly suck them into some sort of higher paying bracket, etc. And they become less keen on it the more you probe. So that's the importance of focus groups as opposed to polls.
But I suppose that also goes to the idea of political leadership, and then you have to try and make an argument for something. Right, enough questions from me. Let's just some of the questions that you've sent in. We've had this question in from Matthew Dowick Thompson.
My name is Matthew and I'm listening to you at the moment in Japan and Singapore, though back in the UK soon. I'd like to know which of you has met the most prime ministers. They don't have to be in power when you met them, and you can define met pretty widely if you like. For example, if Winston Churchill dandled Peter Mandelson on his knee, that would count as a meeting. So over to you. Thanks.
So there we are. Polly, let's be honest, you're half the age of everyone else. How many have you met?
I think five. Blair, very briefly. And weirdly enough, he kind of looks like my dad. So I was sort of chatting to him and felt like we were...
asking him how the garden was.
So anyway, Blair, Brown, Truss, Cameron, I feel like one other. Can't remember. Anyway, I'm the also-ran in this competition.
Boris Johnson?
No, never met him. Never met Boris Johnson either.
No. One, that's only four. Blair, Brown, Cameron, May. Theresa May. You must have met Theresa May.
Theresa May once lent me a towel when I got caught in a rainstorm on the way to her office. So she's my favourite.
There we are. Danny, how many do you think you can clock up?
11.
11? Wow. Oh,
but I must admit that both Ted Heath and Harold Wilson were pretty fleeting. Harold Wilson really just came to my... He had his son at the same school as me, and I met him at a speech day, so it doesn't really count. Ted Heath I did meet a couple of times at political events to do with the Conservative Party. But then after that, the one I really regret not meeting is Jim Callaghan, because I discovered when writing a book about my family that he was a pretty good friend of my grandfather's, and I found him a very compelling character. So they were friends for many, you know, for 25 years. So I it would have been great to have met him, but I didn't. Margaret Thatcher obviously was an extraordinary person to me, and everything that you would think she was, it was very difficult to get a kind of word in edgeways. And then I've worked with quite a few Conservative prime ministers and met obviously Tony Blair and Gordon Brown with varying degrees of cordial.
Struggling to get a word in edgeways, I can't possibly imagine. Peter, how many do you think you can clock off?
I'm nearer 14. 13, 14? 14, yeah.
Wow.
But, I don't want to engage in one-upmanship here.
Nonsense. You like nothing better than
that. But. I was introduced to the post-war Labour Prime Minister, Clement Attlee.
Wow.
When I was 11 years old.
Yeah.
And I was introduced to him.
What, at the end of the Second World War? You were 11?
I was introduced to him in 1965 by the then Prime Minister, Harold Wilson. So one Prime Minister introduced me to another Prime Minister. And at the time... we were in 10 Downing Street.
Amazing. All right, you win that one.
Can I have the bell, please?
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
All right, very good. So you've got 14. I think I managed 8, but who cares about me? Don't forget, if you want to send your questions, you can email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. Attach a voice note if you can, and we're going to do a question special next week. Do that. My thanks to Peter Madison, Polly McKenzie, Daniel Finkelstein. I was Matt Chorley. That was How to Win an Election.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.